You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, U.S. Supreme Court announced this week that it will hear a case on whether the Affordable Care Act is constitutional. Coming up, we look at the origins of the legal challenge, how it could shape the race for president, and what might happen if Obamacare is ultimately struck down. Now, a lot of us might think of peer pressure as a bad thing. We usually hear it in relation to risky behaviors, things like smoking, underage drinking, and more. Peer pressure, more technically behavioral contagion, is a powerful psychological tool. It's why a friend or group of people can get us to do something we might not want to do on our own. But our next guest says that because peer pressure can be such a motivating force, we might be able to use it to address urgent matters, get some positive change, including on issues like climate change. Robert H. Frank is the Henrietta Johnson Lewis Professor of Management and Professor of Economics at Cornell's Johnson Graduate School of Management. He's the author of the new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
I want to start with a couple of the basic comments that underline topics that underline your argument here. First is this idea of behavioral contagion and how powerful it can be. Can you talk to us about that?
You know, the most powerful example I've ever seen, I came across in a film. It was a candid camera film. Alan Funt, the candid camera creator, advertised a great job, high pay, no requirements to speak of. Lots of people applied. They came. They were instructed to sit down in a waiting room. When the subject showed up, there were already four other people in there waiting. We knew they were Confederates of Alan Funt, but he didn't know that. So after a while, we see the camera zoom in on the subject's face. He's impassive. But then suddenly he looks alarmed. The camera pans out, and we see that the reason for his alarm is that the other four, at no apparent signal, have stood up and have started taking off all their clothing. What's going on, he's wondering. And you can see, finally, he gets a more calm expression, and he, too, stands up and takes off all of his clothing. And the scene ends. They're all five standing there naked, waiting for what comes next. And people see this, or at least I did, in the film, and I say to myself, no way would I have done that. But think about it from the perspective of the candidate. It's a much better job than he's got. He does know what's going on. The other four got there before he did. They know what's going on, if anybody does. They seem to think it's worthwhile to go through the next step in the drill. And so what's he to do? It's very hard to find fault with him for being influenced so strongly by his peers in that situation. It seems silly in hindsight, but he didn't know that. And in general, we know very little about what's going on out there in the world. Other people are ignorant, too. But together, others know a lot more than we do. And when we see others taking action confidently, it's at least incumbent on us to ask whether it might be a good thing for us to investigate whether it makes sense to do what they're doing. It won't always, obviously, but sometimes it will.
And on a more serious issue, you consider throughout your book smoking. And the same person, if we grew up in a different time or amidst a different circle, depending on how many people we knew who smoked, that has a big influence on our own ultimate decision on whether to smoke.
Exactly. Yeah, I have four adult sons. None of them smokes. I think if they'd grown up when I did, two or three of them would be smokers. And how can any parent not think of the change in the environment that we've seen happen as anything other than a good thing? It's, of course, a good thing that only 13-14% of the adults in America smoke now. It used to be over 60% when I was a teenager. And you're much, much harder pressed to raise your kids to be non-smokers if many of the people out there in their friendship groups are smokers.
Talking to Robert H. Frank, his new book is Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. That's behavioral contagion, but you can't just count on it happening on its own. And that takes us to another concept I'm quoting here, the idea that we should tax activities that cause harm to others, that can help steer behavioral contagion in the right direction. Can you expand on that that idea?
Yeah, I think there the smoking example is, again, the easiest way to see the underlying point. When you smoke, do you cause harm to others? When we started taxing smoking and regulating it, the excuse we offered was the fact that side stream smoke, secondhand smoke, had been shown to cause injury to others. It was responsible for various illnesses. And that was our rationale. But in fact, the harm from side stream smoke is trivial compared to the harm from actually being a smoker. And the real harm that you do to others when you're a smoker is to make them more likely to smoke. The people who have a big interest in this, the parents of children whom they don't want to see start smoking, have no recourse. You know, if there are many more smokers in the environment, many of those parents will fail in their goal of raising their kids to be non-smokers, and that's harm you've caused to those people if you're a smoker. So unless you think you just have a right to harm others without consequence, it's very hard to object to the fact that the government is trying to discourage you from smoking and thereby discourage you from causing harm to others. So yeah, I think we have clearly an interest in the social environment. We know how powerful its influence is on us. And so when it's a helpful thing to us, we want to encourage behaviors that reinforce that environment. And when it has a distinctly negative influence on us, I think, as in the smoking example, it's useful for us to take steps to discourage that kind of environment.
Now, an argument you might get, actually, you're right, an argument you have gotten is that, well, hold on, if I'm a smoker, maybe there's this behavioral contagion, but ultimately that other person, it's their choice. They're going to make the decision to smoke or not, so don't put that on me and don't tax me or punish me based on my hypothetical influence on that person over there. How do you answer them?
When I hear that objection, I'm very sympathetic to the sentiment that motivates it. We do tell our children that they're responsible for their own decisions, that if they see peers behaving in a way that they know they shouldn't, that it's up to them to resist any temptation to follow those examples. So yes, I like the sentiment that motivates that objection, but think about the parents. Forget about the people causing harm to themselves. It's their responsibility to avoid that, you might hold. But the parents, they've done everything they can to discourage their kids from smoking. You can't push too far or you'll make them more likely to smoke. So they've taken every step possible to discourage their kids from smoking. We know that many of them are going to fail to achieve that goal in an environment in which most of their kids' peers are smokers. And so you're causing harm to those parents by making them unable to achieve a perfectly realistic and laudable goal. Why don't we count that as harm? It's a very palpable harm, really.
So let's take that to global warming, an issue that you talk about in the book, something you say we need to tackle. How do we operationalize this, the power of behavioral contagion on the one hand, and then the idea of taxing activities that cause harm to others to encourage positive behavioral contagion? How does that all come together to help fight climate change?
Well, we know that one of the most powerful explanations for why we do what we do is that other people like us are doing those things. When I was getting married, I had never heard of a destination wedding. Now my kids go to destination weddings all over the world. They're expected to. Some of my sons lately have been expected to go to destination bachelor parties. This is burning up a lot of fuel. There's absolutely no evidence that people would be any less happy if they got married closer to home. We do these trips because others like us are doing them. And so if we would price in the carbon in those trips, that would discourage people from scheduling them. If others didn't do them, we would feel no compunction to do them. The very most important finding is that if others weren't buying the things they're buying, we would feel no need to buy them either in many domains. So the heavy vehicles that Americans started buying, now they're 7,000-8,000 pounds. If you don't have one and others do, you're at greater risk of injury and death. If you buy a bigger one and they buy a bigger one, then the rub is that everybody's at greater risk of injury and death than if everybody were driving a small vehicle. And we don't have to assume that big vehicles are just automatically the right choice. If we taxed vehicles by weight, we'd discourage people from buying big ones. Some would buy smaller, then others would be less at risk. They'd buy smaller too, and we'd see that cascade go in exactly the opposite direction. And the nice twist to that is that we would raise some revenue if we did that. And the revenue we raise in the process, we could use to offset the current taxes we levy on useful activities. Why should we tax business payrolls? That discourages firms from hiring workers. We should reduce those taxes, tax harmful activities. Every dollar you raise lets you reduce the tax on a useful activity.
We're talking to Robert Frank from the Cornell Graduate School of Management. He's with us to talk about his new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. He makes the case that we can use peer pressure to influence action on things like climate change, among other things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea so far, the idea that peer pressure can be an effective motivator and that by taxing things in a different way, we can encourage people to act in ways that that help the society, the planet as a whole, help fight climate change? What questions do you have for our guests about how this all might work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the idea of using peer pressure, behavioral contagion, to fight things like climate change. Economist Robert H. Frank is with us. His new book is called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that peer pressure can be an effective tool to change people's minds about pressing issues, their behaviors? Have you seen it with things in your daily life? Was it easier, say, for you to quit smoking if you were around friends who were non-smokers or vice versa? What do you think of the idea of raising taxes on things that we know might lead to this kind of negative behavior, things like increased cigarette taxes or maybe increased taxes on carbon emissions? What do you think of that idea? Do you have a question for a guest about how this all works? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robert, some people might say, you know, let's not tax things. Let's just regulate. Let's put limits on whatever pollutant we want, whether it's a greenhouse gas or a toxic chemical, we'll regulate it. That's the way to rein in whatever problem we have.
Yeah, we can do that, and we have done that. But economists argued for many decades that the more efficient and fair way to curb pollution is to charge people who pollute in accordance with how much they pollute. It's a myth that firms pollute because they enjoy polluting. That's such a silly idea of firm behavior. Firms pollute because it's costly to filter the pollution out. And economists for decades had been recommending taxes on SO2. When I first got to Cornell, all we read about was acid rain destroying the forests and fisheries here in the Northeast. Firms in the Midwest were discharging SO2 from their smokestacks, burning high sulfur coal. Once we finally enacted the economist's recommendation and charged people for emitting SO2 into the air, the concentrations of it fell sharply at about 1/6 the cost that had been projected under direct regulation, and we now never hear anything at all about acid rain. And that's something we should have also done long since with CO2. We knew CO2 was a problem back in the 1980s. There were reports that warming was already well underway. We have, though, resisted for the most part taxing CO2 emissions, and it's something we really ought to do. And again, nobody likes taxes, but if you say there shouldn't be any taxes, you're not really in the conversation. The question is, what should we tax and at what rate should we tax it? And right now, we're taxing a lot of useful things. Dumping carbon into the air is not a useful behavior. It's a harmful behavior. If we taxed it, we could reduce taxes on useful behavior. So that's really a compellingly advantageous step to take. And the added bonus is that when some respond by cutting back on their carbon emissions, the new habits they adopt turned out to have much more impact than anyone realized because they launch a contagion process among people that they know. So there's just a lot of easy fruit to be picked here.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Stevens Point. Lynn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lynn?
I was going to bring up my kids when they were in from K through 12 had the option of either a vegetarian lunch or animal product in their lunch. And I think just the peer pressure of seeing that it even existed, number one, and then that there's other choices, because animal protein, as we know, physical space it takes up and the amount of water to grow grain and to produce animal protein, I think that would be something that peer pressure could, you know, just for one thing, give people who aren't even aware that of how that impacts global, you know, climate change.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Robert, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great point, and there's really very persuasive evidence of strong contagion in that domain. The study that's, I think, most dramatic was one that showed that when a military family was posted to a new location, if the obesity rate in the new location was 1% higher than where they had been, the adult members of the family in the new location were 5% more likely to become obese when they were moved to the new location. It's a huge effect. We don't understand fully all the mechanisms that produce it, but people do mimic the behavior of their peers in both diet and their exercise and other factors that are implicated. So we know that if some switch what they eat, others are going to be influenced by those decisions too.
Thanks, Lynn, for that call. We're talking to Robert H. Frank about his new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. We'll go back to your calls now. Tyler is with us in Green Bay. Tyler, hello.
Hi. I've got two comments for the guest, or two questions. First would be, would peer pressure possibly, peer pressure have a negative effect? In the sense, like, I think of social media, when people disagree with views, it's more of an attack. And then the second one is, I think an excise tax would be a really good idea, especially when a lot of times it's not things we have to do, but it's a choice we have to do those.
Tyler, thanks a lot for that call. First, that negative reaction, Robert, if we had, say, a lot of messages in front of us saying, you know, don't eat meat, eat vegetarian, or we've seen it with some people react to even anti-smoking messages this way, can it provoke the opposite response that you might be hoping for?
Yeah, I think when people feel like they're being preached at, there often is a reaction, and we see a counterproductive result in some of those cases. So I think setting a good example is often more powerful than trying to preach to somebody. There is at least research suggesting that. The tax approach is more neutral. And I think the tendency is to object to a tax because it's unpleasant to pay it. But in the case of the carbon tax, it's just been a failure of political imagination for leaders not to explain carefully to voters that we could make the carbon tax revenue neutral. And what that means is that they collect all the revenue that comes in from the tax, a disproportionate share of which would come from high-income consumers because they use much more energy per capita than others, and then give the revenue back to low and middle income families in equal monthly checks. And you'd find 80% to 90% of all voters getting more money back each month than they had actually paid in carbon taxes. It's still more expensive to do carbon intensive things, so everybody would still have a very strong incentive to cut back. But it would not be a burden on low and middle income families, as has often been charged. And I think it's a failure of political leadership not to explain that more clearly to the voters.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hello.
Hello. My question or comment has to do with the carbon tax being passed on from the corporations to consumers. If a company is levied a carbon tax and they are selling a good or service to a consumer that is necessary, like heating for your home, and that cost is passed on to the consumer, it doesn't really change the corporate behavior. And people, especially in low-income groups, have very little leeway in how they, you know, spend their money.
Got it, Gwen. Thanks for the call. So, yeah, what do you think, Robert?
Yeah, that's the case just as clearly as it possibly could be made for making the tax revenue neutral. We want carbon-intensive activities to be more expensive, even for low-income families. We can cushion the blow to them by giving the revenue that we collect from those carbon taxes back to the families. So they'll have more money than before, many of them. And some object, well, doesn't that mean they'll still do wasteful things? No, because the energy-intensive choices will be more expensive relative to the energy-saving choices that they could have made. So they'll have just as strong an incentive to switch from high-carbon activities to low-carbon activities, but it will not be an unacceptable hardship for them in the process.
Thanks for the call, Gwen. In our last minute, Robert, you mentioned that one objection to tackling climate change in the U.S. is that, well, we're just part of the story. The rest of the world would need to get on board, too. Do you think in international relations there could be this sort of behavioral contagion, peer pressure?
Oh, we've seen it again and again. When Stockholm adopts a congestion fee, it was very unpopular at first, but then other countries and cities saw that it worked out quite well there. The motorists are really very much in favor of this measure now. Now there are many cities around the world suddenly willing to consider it because they've seen how it worked so well in Stockholm. And if we tax carbon and other countries don't, yeah, that would be a problem. But if they want to sell their goods here, we can tax the carbon content of their goods when they enter the country. And rather than let us keep the revenue from a carbon tax on their goods, they'll impose their own carbon tax. That's the best response they would have.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Robert H. Frank, the Henrietta Johnson Lewis Professor of Management and Professor of Economics at Cornell University. He joined us for a look at his new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work, where he argues that peer pressure may be one of the most effective ways to combat climate change. Coming up, we'll see what's working and what isn't with the Affordable Care Act and how the U.S. Supreme Court could affect the type of health care provided in this country. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, a new state law changes the way police body cam records are stored and handled. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the director of a group that advocates for police officers about the changes and what they could mean. It's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now the fate of the Affordable Care Act once again lies with the U.S. Supreme Court. It announced this week that it would take up an appeal brought by 20 Democratic-led states. Wisconsin is not one of those. A federal judge in Texas ruled in 2018 that the health care law's individual mandate, that's the requirement that people buy insurance or pay a fine, is unconstitutional, making the entire law invalid. A federal appeals court agreed on the individual mandate, but it didn't resolve whether the whole law should therefore be struck down. The Supreme Court is expected to hear the case in its next term, which runs from October to June, so it's unlikely that it's going to be decided before the November presidential election. In 2012, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to uphold Obamacare. Back then, the court said the individual mandate amounted to a tax and thus found the law to be legal. Allison Hoffman is a professor at Penn Law School. Her areas of expertise include health law, healthcare policy, and healthcare regulation. She's also co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, it was a tangled story there going through the courts to come to the Supreme Court again. Let's start with this idea that the individual mandate would kill the whole Affordable Care Act, according to this judge in Texas. What was the argument there?
So the argument there is one based on an idea that we call severability in the law. And the question is, if the individual mandate goes, if the court says the individual mandate's unconstitutional and you have to strike it, can the rest of the law stand without it? Or is it so critical to the entire law that if you strike the mandate, the law no longer makes sense and the whole law must go? As you can imagine, if you know anything about the Affordable Care Act, thinking about this mandate, which was zeroed out which was zeroed already, so people don't have to comply with it now and the law is still standing. It's really a farcical kind of argument that the law, which has so many provisions which have absolutely nothing to do with the individual mandate, relies so deeply on this provision that if this provision is no longer law, that the whole law has to go. But that that absurd position is indeed what one district court judge in Texas said, and so thus it is a piece that has been threading through the argument. Will that be the fate of the Affordable Care Act? I'm pretty confident no, but it is one possibility.
Yeah, the Supreme Court had previously decided that the individual mandate was a tax, and that was when you still had to pay money if you didn't get health care coverage under the individual mandate. As you mentioned, Republicans removed the money part of it. So with that change, is it possible now the Supreme Court could look at it differently?
They might. I mean, this is the first part of the analysis, which is if the individual mandate is constitutional because it's a tax, if you no longer have to pay a tax penalty, is it still a tax? Is it still constitutional? And so very literally, perhaps it's not. And then maybe you can't uphold it as constitutional on the basis that it's a tax. But the larger question there, which is in the fifth, which is what the dissenter in the Fifth Circuit, the point that she made, which is if what the law says is you hold insurance or nothing, then is there really anything to even argue that that's unconstitutional? It's kind of like it's like advice. You should hold insurance, and if you don't, then nothing will happen. Or, it's a suggestion by the law. And so really what's so unconstitutional about that at all is difficult to know. But that's the first question is, is an individual mandate with no tax penalty, is it unconstitutional? And it's possible the court might say that. That's indeed what the district court said on appeal. That's what two judges in the Fifth Circuit said. And it's possible the Supreme Court might say that. So that's the first question. And then if you say yes, the mandate is unconstitutional, which I think is a stretch of an argument, but you might say yes to that, then what does it mean for the rest of the law is the secondary question.
Let's tackle both of those possible outcomes here. First of all, I guess the court could say, hey, everything's fine the way it is, nothing changes, that we just continue on as we are. But one possibility is, as you were saying, they say, yeah, the individual mandate is unconstitutional, but no, that doesn't kill the whole rest of the Affordable Care Act. In general, if that's their ruling, nobody's going to feel a change from that, are they?
Probably not. So there is a question of degrees there. They might say that the individual mandate is unconstitutional and the entire law doesn't have to go, but there's a few provisions that are so tightly intertwined with the individual mandate that they have to go. And what are those provisions? Those are things like the requirement that insurers issue insurance to anybody who applies. Those are the requirements that say you can't charge people differently based on their health status. You can't exclude pre-existing conditions. Those are the parts of the laws that are the most tightly intertwined conceptually with the individual mandate. So there's this middle ground as well. But if they say the first piece, which you suggested, which is that the mandate's unconstitutional and the rest of the law can stand without it, then nobody will feel a thing. It will feel exactly as it does today, which is a law with a mandate that has been where the penalty has been zeroed out. If they take the intermediate position, some people will indeed feel that, especially people who have pre-existing conditions or who have conditions that might cause or other characteristics that might cause an insurer not want to issue them coverage.
Talking to Allison Hoffman from Penn Law School, looking at the Affordable Care Act coming again before the U.S. Supreme Court. We're looking at what might change if they rule different ways. Allison, we've talked about kind of the little change, no change options. What if, and it sounds like you're saying this is unlikely, but what if they said, yes, the individual mandate is unconstitutional, and yes, the whole thing's gone. The whole Affordable Care Act is gone as a result. Again, a less likely option, I'm hearing you saying, but where does that leave our healthcare system if that did happen?
I would be shocked if that happened, and it would leave us with a great deal of chaos on the ground. If you think about what the Affordable Care Act rolled out, it was not just changes that made it more feasible for people to buy individual coverage on their own. It was exchanges set up by the federal government in the many states to sell people insurance. It was a huge Medicaid expansion, which has been responsible for the largest number of increases in coverage across the country. It's investments in training and rural health. It's public health investments. All of these pieces, which are pretty far conceptually from what the individual mandate does would all kind of be wiped out at once. And then what that would mean is everybody would look to Congress and say, well, what are you going to do to replace this thing? And as anybody who follows Congress knows, they're not an extraordinarily nimble organization lately. So they will be slow to respond to that call. But I think that outcome is unlikely, but it would be extraordinarily shocking and disruptive, not just to the millions of people who've gained coverage under the law, but to the hospitals and to the doctors who have adjusted how they do business and who have more business coming in the doors from people who have insurance who can pay for health care than they did before, and for the many people who are trying to improve on the public health system and especially access to care in rural areas for people who are working on health care delivery. It would be disruptive across the board.
Allison, a lot of the focus has kind of been an all or nothing on the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have made efforts to repeal it, Democrats defending it, or maybe looking to scrap the whole thing and replace it with some kind of Medicare for all. I've talked to some health policy people who say, hey, we've got this. We should be working on fine-tuning it, clearing up unintended consequences, finding ways to work within the framework we have. Has much of that happened, though, over the years since the Affordable Care Act passed?
Well, the Affordable Care Act passed a decade ago, and the Obama administration they were in charge of the initial rollout of the law and the kind of initial process of seeing, well, how do these things work? What doesn't work well? How do we fix the things that don't work well? So we were just starting to go down that pathway as a country of seeing the pieces that weren't working quite as intended or unintended consequences of the law. And then trying to figure out how do you fix these things. When the Trump administration took office, and largely what they've been trying to do rather than fill in these gaps is dismantle the pieces of the law one at a time. And so, you know, in terms of fixing problems like who don't qualify for subsidies when they're buying individual insurance or finding it unaffordable, that's one thing you could imagine policymakers trying to fix. But that's not where this particular administration is focused. They're not really trying to find the gaps that are making insurance unaffordable or healthcare unaffordable for Americans and ameliorate those. They're trying to chip away at the law as is, you know, as they can do through the administrative process.
We've seen in Democratic primaries in the 2018 election, Allison, a lot of Democratic voters seem to think healthcare is a big issue as they go to the polls. A lot of candidates selling their various health plans. How important an issue do you see this, especially with what's going on in the court now in the 2020 election campaign?
It will be the number one issue. It has been as you look at exit polls and what people are saying is on their minds as they're, you know, as they're going to vote, and it will continue to be, especially as you see healthcare is top of the news in many different ways every day. So if it's not, you know, coronavirus today, it's the Supreme Court hearing a case on abortion, it's the Obamacare case. I mean, healthcare is just top of the news, it's top of people's minds, and it will continue to be all the way through this election. Of course, the specific conversation will shift as what we're looking at, you know, is a debate between President Trump and whoever the Democratic nominee is, but the fact that it's top of mind will stay all the way through the election cycle.
We're talking about the 10-year journey of the Affordable Care Act and question marks about its future as the Supreme Court takes up the issue in its next term. And it's a big issue, as we were just hearing, in this current election campaign. Allison Hoffman is our guest. She's a professor at Penn Law School and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you hope comes out of this U.S. Supreme Court case on the Affordable Care Act? And what do you want to hear candidates for president, candidates for Congress talking about? What kind of options do you want them considering debating in this presidential and congressional race? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at the uncertain future of the Affordable Care Act. The U.S. Supreme Court announced this week it would take up an appeal by 20 Democratic-led states after lower courts deemed the individual mandate unconstitutional. Penn Law School professor Allison Hoffman stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you want to see the Supreme Court strike down the entire Affordable Care Act? Sounds like a long shot, according to our guest in this case, or let it go as is? What do you want to hear presidential candidates talking about? Keeping the Affordable Care Act, trying to fix it, repealing and replacing it, Medicare for all, some kind of more available public option? Or do you have questions about what any of those things mean? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think there was an opportunity very early in Trump's administration to do something different with health care. The Republicans were pushing under Romney and Ryan to have more of what's a refundable tax credit for insurance. Trump is not an ideologue. He's pretty pragmatic, and I think he would have went along with it. Problem is the Democrats' Trump derangement syndrome was so strong that they went the direction of resisting as opposed to trying to find a different path to get to the same result of universal health care through refundable tax credits. So I'd love to see someone, you know, bring that plan or that idea back to the forefront during this cycle.
Steve, thanks for the call. Allison, the idea of refundable tax credits for health care, is that something that would have gotten us closer to universal coverage, as Steve was saying?
Well, the concept that people should get, you know, some form of tax credit to pay for health care is what a large part of the Affordable Care Act is based on. And so if you think about the exchanges where people are buying insurance individually, the people who are lower income, who need help to be able to do so, are getting exactly that. They're getting a tax credit in the form of a premium subsidy to buy insurance. And the bedrock of this idea in the Affordable Care Act came from Romney. It came from Massachusetts. So this kind of idea of, you know, what does health insurance look like if it's a compromised version of health insurance is really at the core of the Affordable Care Act. And I think the harder question is, why have Republicans turned away from this idea, which really started as an idea from conservative think tanks and which Romney supported in Massachusetts, instead of trying to make it work better than it does for the people who remain uninsured?
Thanks for the call, Steve. We'll go to Phil with us now in Milwaukee. Phil, hi.
Yes, I just have a comment about healthcare in general. When I went to work for a living, and I'm going to age myself, it was 1979. The point I tried to make was there was three people in the healthcare system. It was me, the doctor, and the company. Now it's the company, the people who handle the paperwork for the company, the people who distribute the funds for the company, the multi-conglomerate healthcare facilities, and the doctor. Everybody wants to know why healthcare is so expensive. And now you have five people in the pie when you only had two or three at the time. There's probably even more than that.
Phil, thanks for the call. Do you see that as part of the driver of our cost of healthcare in this country, Allison? The bureaucracy involved in the system as we've built it up?
It absolutely is. It's not the only driver, but it's definitely one driver. I have a forthcoming piece, and I call it healthcare's market bureaucracy, because part of why we've gotten to this point is that we've really looked to the market and market players to run our healthcare system in a way that other countries haven't. And it's created many layers of administration that are arguably not creating a lot of value and are adding a lot of cost. Now, the question of what to do at this point is a tough one, and that's some of what you're seeing in the debates over how to move forward at this point is, can you start to unravel this really complicated system that we've built up over so many years, especially when every one of those layers is jobs and is profits and is every dollar of the system and cost is profit for somebody. And so then to scale that back and to roll that back becomes really quite hard once you've rolled it out. But it's a way that our system differs from other countries, and it's a large part of, or it's a part at least, of why our system is so expensive.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Penn Law School professor Allison Hoffman about the Affordable Care Act's future as it waits for a hearing in the Supreme Court over a constitutional challenge. Let's go back to your calls now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hello. I'd like to talk about socialized medicine. It's a nightmare, okay? It's not regulated. It's the worst dental care a person could ever get. We need the competition of private insurance, okay? And we need to make it so the insurance companies, and so does the legislator, that if the insurance companies become accountable, we should be able to go to Mayo Clinic, any doctor, dentist, hearing test, any ambulance. We're paying insurances. We're all going to pay for it. So why can't we have the best?
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. So a couple different messages there. She's concerned about the idea of, it sounds like some kind of a single payer or like government-run healthcare system, but it sounds like she wants heavier regulations on insurance providers, Allison.
So it's a complicated set of issues. The thing I would say is something that people don't really understand about a lot of the restrictions that you face in the system now. If you go to somebody and you learn that the specialist you want to go to is out of network, or you get a bill for an ambulance ride because they're out of network, that's a product of the complicated system of private insurance we have. And when you have something like, let's imagine a single payer system in the form of Medicare for all, that at least that layer of frustration, it's not that the health system would be without frustration, but that layer of frustration this disappears, because if you think about the Medicare program, if you have traditional Medicare, you can go to any provider who participates in Medicare. So you don't hit all of these kind of administrative hurdles and restrictions on choosing the provider you want in a way that you do in private insurance. I think that's a misconception people often have about how some kind of single payer system would work. You could try to regulate the private insurers to get them to open up the doors in that kind of way, but really that is contrary to what private insurance is doing, which is they're trying to offer the lowest priced insurance package by, in part, negotiating with a smaller network of providers so they can bring down the price of premiums. It's really like it's a core part of the business model of how private insurance works.
Thanks for that call. Allison, you've written, I think, about the market for healthcare and the idea of consumer choice, and that being complicated because this is such a difficult thing to shop for, healthcare coverage, given all the variables. What are some of the challenges there if we are counting on the market and consumer choice to help fix our system?
So one of the things I've written about is that we definitely have put a lot of emphasis on the idea of choice. And the way that's translated into policy is valuing the notion of choice of health plan. But if you step back from that and you think about what do we really care about and being able to steer our own pathway through the medical care system, it has very little to do with whether my plan comes from one insurer or another or whether it's Medicare. It has to do with being able to go to a doctor who I have a relationship with and care about. It has to do with being able to get the necessary medical care to be healthy and not kind of face financial insecurity at the end of the day, not end up with large bills. So I think that we have really misplaced the notion of where the value of freedom or autonomy exists in the system as resting on this notion of choice of health plans. And there's a ton of evidence that shows that people have a really hard time navigating choice of health plan. It's really complicated. It requires kind of parsing through the kind of health insurance lingo and the complications of the different ways that health plans are structured and the networks that is often indecipherable to you know, even people who understand the stuff quite well. I've tried to help family members figure out what supplemental Medicare plan to buy, a private insurance plan to go along with Medicare. And I understand insurance quite well. And I often, at the end of the day, can't figure out exactly why one plan costs more than another or what doctors you could go to in one plan versus another. So, you know, the notion that this is something that's really valuable, you know, the ability to kind of have to wade through these choices and, for many of us, make the choice at the end of the day that it may not be the best choice for us, I think it is, you know, really, we really need to push back on that and say, where do we really care about being able to steer our pathway through this system?
And Allison, we'll leave it there and watch as this develops. Thanks to Allison Hoffman, professor at Penn Law School and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. She joined us for a look at the uncertain future of the Obamacare, with the Supreme Court picking up a challenge to it in their next session. Up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll add some fun to your oatmeal. Sounds boring? I'll tell you, oatmeal fans, they're really into their oatmeal. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.